You know I've raved about outer before, and I love my outer sofa, outdoor dining table, and chairs. I've had them for over a year, and let me tell you, they've been through everything, from rainstorms to scorching sun, and still look brand new.
That's because outer makes outdoor furniture that's actually designed for the outdoors. From using incredibly durable and sustainable materials to developing innovative solutions like the outer shell cover, which protects my sofa and dining table against dust, debris, and dirt. No more soggy cushions or dusty tabletops. My outer setup is always clean, dry, and ready to be enjoyed anytime I want.
Head to liveouter.com/thefounderhour to see Outer's range of outdoor furniture, fire pits, and accessories. The Founder Hour listeners get an exclusive 10% off for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply.
So elevate your outdoor space with Outer. That's liveouter.com/thefounderhour.
Hey everyone, before we get into the episode, just a quick reminder, if you enjoy what you hear, please follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That way you get notified when new episodes drop. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, at The Founder Hour. Let's get into it.
Cole Needham, welcome to the show. We're excited to have you here and, you know, kind of go through your early days and your story and all the way up to IMDb and what you're up to now. You know, really excited to dive in, but pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to talk to you on Oscar weekend as well.
Oscar weekend. Where are you based right now? Are you?
I'm based in Bristol in the UK.
And is that where you grew up mostly, around there? Or
no, I actually grew up in Manchester, which is a town up in the north, somewhat of a industrial heartland kind of town. Grew up in a small suburb outside of there, and but I've lived in Bristol for 35 years now.
It's amazing. I just visited London for the first time last year, and I loved it. My dad grew up there, and so he's always telling me to go. He grew up in the Chiswick area and Chelsea and those parts. But I love the city, and I'm just curious, growing up, you know, what was life like for you? What did you like to spend your time doing on a day-to-day basis?
Unsurprisingly, I spent my life watching movies. So my earliest memories are all in movie theaters in the Manchester area. There's a fun little story about my very first time in a movie theater. If you're interested,
would love to hear about it.
A longer, deeper background here. So I was 5 years old. I was staying with my grandmother one night, and she said to me, "Would you like to enter a colouring competition?" And in the local newspaper, there was a scene from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which was on one of those re-releases that they used to do from time to time. This is 1972. And the competition, colouring the scene from Snow White, and they will judge your entry in their competition. And the winners in the various different age groups would win tickets to go and see Snow White at the big theatre in the middle of Manchester. And I won. I won.
So you must have been a good colouring person.
Well, there's more of a story. I know we're on a podcast, but I actually have a copy of the letter here that wow. That indicates that I won. My grandma and I, we went in a taxi to the big cinema. I saw my first movie in a cinema, which was obviously Snow White, and I fell in love with movies at that point.
What was it about? Was it just the setting? Was it the big screen? What was it that drew you so much to the cinema?
I think it was the big screen, being in the dark with the big screen, an amazing story. I mean, it's such a timeless classic, Snow White. And so I think I was very, very lucky to go and see a really great movie as my first cinema experience. And the fact that I'd won a colouring competition and we went in a taxi to get to the middle of town added to that excitement. But I do have a little confession to make about all of this. So round about 15 years ago, I was talking to my grandmother about IMDb and all of the wonderful things and the change it's had on my life and everything that, that the company and what we do means to me. And I said to her, I said, it's all thanks to that colouring competition that I won when I was five. And she looked at me with this kind of look of horror. And she said, oh. And I said, what do you mean, oh? And she said, well, I've got a terrible confession to make. After you went to bed that night, I just couldn't help but colour in all of those bits that you'd missed. And all of the colours that you'd gotten wrong. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. If you're familiar with the movie Fight Club, I'm not going to spoil Fight Club for anyone who hasn't seen it, although you have for 25 years. There's a moment in that movie where Ed Norton's character finds out what's really going on. And I feel like I've lived that moment in my life because my grandmother tells me that we essentially, unbeknownst to me, cheated in the colouring competition. So my hobby, my passion in life, my job, my role, my career, everything that I do is built on this fraudulent competition.
But you know, Cole, doesn't that kind of speak a lot of to, you know, perception, right? In a sense of, you know, if you perceive it or if you believe it, you can make it happen. And I think sometimes as entrepreneurs, you know, business owners, whatever you want to call it, you know, you have this, like, you know, almost like this fake narrative that you create in your head that you could do something that most people probably will tell you that you're crazy. And, you know, I feel like there's a parallel there to entrepreneurship of, like, you know, fake it till you make it. Like, yeah, in this case, you didn't know. But, you know, had you lost that competition, right, IMDb might have never been.
Yep. I mean,
sounds like your grandmother deserves to have 50% equity in the company.
Well, there you go.
She was your co-founder without you knowing it.
Without me knowing, it was instilled into me. I mean, it's funny, and I know you like to go kind of deep background in these podcasts. So I have actually a related story that I've never told anybody ever before. And because listening to some of your recent episodes, I'm thinking, well, where did some of that spark originate? And my grandmother's partly responsible for this as well. So I grew up in a single parent family, so it was just myself, my younger brother, and my mother. And my grandparents owned a convenience store. And during the school vacations, it was a good thing for me to be able to help in the store, because then my mother didn't have to worry about kind of getting babysitting services or whatever, and I could help in the candy area of the store, selling candy bars to customers that came in. And I think I was about 8 or 9, and it was a quiet moment in the store. And we had these kind of like little soft candy sticks that were, at least as far as I can remember, they were half a penny. So this is UK money back in the 70s, mm-hmm. Half a penny for these things. And so I ended up, I got two of them And I got one of the paper bags that we used to put the candies in. And I kind of like drew a smiley face on the paper bag and put the candy bars in, kind of sticking out, kind of like rabbit ears out of the top of the candy bars. And I made a few of these up and I put them in the kind of candy store cabinet. And then the next customer that came in, they obviously, like, I know this now, like 8-9 year old me, they probably took pity on me and said, "Oh, what are those? And I said, "Well, oh, these are our new smiley candy bars." And they're 1.5p. So that's 2 half-pence candy bars, and then half a penny for my labor in creating the smiley face with the paper bag. And so they bought one. and my grandmother's like, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Well,
how did you, I mean, at that young age, do you think it just came to you that you're like, I need to mark this up and make my profit and
be
this like enterprising?" Yeah.
I have no idea, like, what 8 or 9 year old me was even thinking with this, but I'd made a sale, and so then I'm busy making the next one to replace the one I've just sold, and then somebody else came in and bought one, and I have no idea how many little half pence markups I actually made, but it was a nice amount, and in a brilliant sort of circular economy type thing. Of course, what did I do with all of my halfpence profit? But actually spend it on more candy for me. So I think my grandmother won. She won either way on this one, and that's my earliest entrepreneurial memory. That is in my head.
Yeah. You know, often when a kid is into movies, it always translates to, not always, but a lot of times translates to, like, well, I want to become a filmmaker when I grow up. I want to make movies instead of, you know, maybe like just consume movies or be in the movie business adjacently, right? Did you ever have that aspiration to actually want to be a filmmaker? No, you just wanted to just be in the business. And you just, well, or not even, you just like movies. You just like watching movies.
I just like movies, and we'll come on to this later. But there was no concept of having a career in movies in Manchester, England, 1970s. That's just not something that was on the cards and anything that you would think about. And one of the I'm actually involved in a film education charity in the UK, and one of the things that charity aims to do is to let young people know that you can have a career in the movies. And even if you live in Manchester, if you live in the far reaches of Scotland, if you live on a remote island, there are careers that you can follow within the entertainment industry, and while simultaneously appealing to your own passion. So if you're somebody who's like amazing with sound, check career in that. If you are a visual person, obviously check career in that. But if you're just brilliant with numbers, then maybe you can work in finance and accounting within movies there. Or if you're brilliant at creating things with your hands, there's the whole range of art department careers that can exist. But certainly for me, back in the 1970s in the north of England, any kind of career in the movies just wouldn't make sense. I am absolutely on a consumer of filmed entertainment. I'm a huge fan. I'm now at the point the timing of this is quite interesting. I just rated on IMDb my 15,500th unique movie. So I've been tracking every movie that I've seen since the 1st of January 1980, and here we are today, 15,500. 15,500. And that's unique movies as well. So my all-time favorite movie is Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. I've seen it more than 50 times, but it just counts for one of the 15,500.
Would do you agree with the IMDb top? I think it was like 250 or 200 or
250. I love the top 250. I now the funny thing is I'm at 249 of 250.
Which one haven't you seen?
Godzilla Minus One, because I was traveling earlier in the year. I was in the US. My wife and I, we were at the Sundance Film Festival. And we missed the movie while it was in theaters. Got back to the UK. It's in the top 250. It's in the top 250. And then it's now not available in this kind of like mysterious rights and licensing issue, because they don't want two Godzilla movies to be out at the same time.
Interesting.
So you
they also don't want you to have seen all 250, probably.
Yeah. So for me, this is you've caught me a very rare instance in time where I haven't seen all of the top 250. And the top 250, it's shaped by we have 200 million people visit IMDb every single month. Anybody can register. You can vote for any movie, any TV show, even any podcast episode, any video game that you've seen or watched on our 1 to 10 scale. And then we generate a top 250 movies, top 250 TV series. We generate that multiple times per day, just using everybody's aggregated ratings. And so it gives you a fascinating set of movies. And I always say to people, if they say, well, you know, where should I start? I'm getting into movies, but like what should I see? Go to the top 250 and watch the things that don't appeal to you. And you will be surprised, because all of the movies on there are objectively great right. in some way or another. Now, you may not always, as any audience member, you may not always connect with every right. single movie that's on that list. But hopefully you could admire the fact that, oh, wow, I can see why this movie is beloved by so many other people, even though it doesn't work for me. And that's the beauty of movies for me, that kind of like everybody brings their unique experiences of what they've experienced in their life, the movies that they've already seen leading up to that point, but equally importantly are all of the movies that you've not seen. Because right. you may go into a movie that perhaps someone like me, who's seen 15,500 movies, would go, this movie is rather like this one from 10 years ago. But if you didn't see that movie from 10 years ago, and that's the first time experiencing like a super brilliant twist or a flashback that does something in a flashback that you haven't seen before, but other people with deeper film history have seen, that right. experience for you is very, very unique.
And on that note, do you feel like you see that often? Like, you know, people always these days keep saying, well, Hollywood's lacking originality. It's like, you know, we keep using the same stuff over and over again. But as someone who's seen so many films, does that pattern happen a lot? Or are you still seeing so many like new things that you've never seen before where you're like, wow?
Yep. I'm always seeing new things, and I never get tired of this. And I think I think the 15,500 is quite a testament to that to that fact.
Is that like a Guinness World Record at this point?
No. Now I haven't looked at this in a very, very long time. But I do remember that there was someone who's maybe seen more than 20,000 in theatres.
In theatres.
And the way they prove that to Guinness is they had all their ticket stubs for the 20,000.
Well, what if they bought the stubs but they never went to see it?
Ooh, oh my goodness.
I mean,
for the memories.
I'm looking right now. It says as of September 2023, Zach Swope holds the Guinness World Record for the most movies watched in a cinema in 1 year, which was 777 movies in 1 year.
Wow. Okay.
And that now was that's in 2022 to 2023.
Right. Okay. And that's so the interesting thing there. So I track all of my viewing. So I can tell you how many movies I've seen in any year from now all the way back to 1980. So last year I saw 863 movies in the 23 calendar year, but they weren't all in theaters.
I didn't even know they had that many movies in theaters. That's a lot of movies. Right.
Yeah, no. Let me think. I mean, a good proxy for this. So, for example, the Oscars will have round about 300 ish movies that will be eligible for the Oscars in each year. And for that, you have to have played for there are various different aspects to this rule, but essentially you have to have been in a theatre for a week at some point during the calendar year, either in LA or New York. So there are that many out there. And of course, these days when you've got so many choices in terms of how you see movies, it's not uncommon for a streaming service to book a week in a theatre before it goes onto the streaming platform so that then it qualifies for the Oscar run. So
Cole, is that why Netflix and Amazon and all these are trying to essentially have a physical component also? Like, they want to have their own movie theaters at some point as well. I think Netflix already might.
Yes.
Is that part of the reasoning?
That is part of the reasoning, and that's absolutely why you would do it for the 1 week booking. So if you ever see a movie that's coming to a streaming service, and you'll be looking, going, oh, I'm really looking forward to seeing this on Friday, and then you discover it's in your local movie theater the week before, then that's going to be specifically to make sure that it qualifies for an Oscar run. However, there's a very other sensible reason to place your movie in a theatre, and that's because you can make money from the ticket sales while it's in general distribution. And so if you happen to have the kind of movie that people are going to come out, go to the local theatre, pay money to see it, then that's great. I always have a preference. If I can, I would like to see all my movies in a theatre with an audience. But that's not possible.
I was going to say also that these days it feels like it's not just any theater. It's like the 70mm IMAX, you know, the whole like experience. And so there's only a limited number of them. I mean, in LA around me, there's probably like a few, like a handful. And so whenever, you know, like Dune 2 just came out and I'm looking for tickets and it's like 3 months away because there's only limited seats, you know? So it's like maybe they need to convert every theater into a 70mm IMAX now or something.
I saw Dune Part 2 last week. My wife and I went to see it on last Sunday afternoon, and it was fabulous. We went to see it in the we don't have an IMAX theater too close by, so instead we went to see it on the largest screen in the largest cinema in the area Sunday afternoon, and the theater was packed, and that has to have an impact in terms of how you're absorbed in the story, no distractions. you're surrounded by audience members who may be audibly gasping at some of the spectacle that you're seeing on the screen, or you can kind of feel the tension in those tense moments. So that's always a great way to experience a movie. But not everybody has the financial resources to do that. Not everybody can easily make it to a theatre. Not everybody can see all of their 863 planned movies yeah. in a theatre across the year. Such people might be flying in planes around the world or visiting other places and need to be able to see things. So the next best thing to the theatrical experience is a great experience at home. And then the next best thing is an experience where you're watching the thing. Even I don't mind. I really don't mind if you're watching on your iPad or if you're watching on your iPhone even. I mean, obviously, depending on the nature of the story, I think you'd lose a lot in Dune Part 2 on an iPhone. But a real tragedy would be not seeing it at all.
Right.
Not seeing it at all is the tragedy. So anything that enables audiences to see more movies has a big mm-hmm. positive check mark in my book.
So taking it back, you're this kid, have this passion for movies, but not necessarily this want to be in the movie industry necessarily, just having this passion. You also were a really good computer programmer, from what I read, and you taught yourself how to, program computers as a teenager. Talk to us a little bit about that and how you even fell into that and came to want to study that in college, and obviously made it, your career is like sort of the intersection of those two. So
it is, yeah. It is. So everything I can always trace back to the movies. I am the right age for the first Star Wars film. I saw many, many science fiction films with sophisticated computers and storytelling about imagined futures that are yet to exist. And as a kid, of course, sometimes you're not actually aware that, oh, they can't make computers that do this kind of thing yet, or this isn't actually possible. Hey, it's in a movie, it must be there, thinks little 8, 9, 10-year-old me. So I'd become fascinated in technology, and I'm very fortunate, I think, in terms of when I was born. When I was born plays a large part of the success that I've been very fortunate to experience, because as a 12-year-old, the home computer revolution was just beginning in the UK. And so for my Christmas present that year, 1979, I got my first home computer, build-it-yourself kit, 256 bytes of memory, calculator display. You would program it in hexadecimal, and you could barely do anything with this thing. But I'm self-taught programmer. Got the thing, built it, figured out how it worked, took the example programs that came with it and learned how things fitted together, and began to write software in 256 bytes, which teaches you to be very efficient and very thoughtful about the kind of programs that you write. But technology, the wonderful thing about technology is even if you're not involved in its creation, independent of you, it is getting twice as good every 18 months and twice as cheap every 18 right. months. So right. within a year, I had a computer with 1K of memory, 1,024 bytes. And so my programming skills were up a little bit better. And then within another year, I then had a 48K memory computer with a screen and with a keyboard. And that's where things really started to take off. So that's 1981.
And Cole, by that time in 1981, you had mentioned earlier that you started tracking or rating movies in 1980. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Well. Yes and no. So let me set the scene a little bit. So it's 1981.
Yeah.
The home
and
video.
You're still in Manchester at the time.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm 14 years old. 1981, and our family get our first VCR, and there begins my real dive into the world of film, because prior to that point, we had three TV channels in the UK, and that was it, and I would have to wait for a movie to be broadcast on one of those three channels. All of a sudden, VCR, we could go and we could rent movies. A family friend had an electronics store, and they had a sort of like a little shelf full of movies, and they would drop off a VHS tape on a two-week rental. Well, not rental, because they were a family friend. They'd leave the tape with us for 2 weeks, and then they'd pop in and pick it back up and drop off the next tape. So as a 14-year-old in 1981, I saw Alien 14 times in 14 days.
You're so, like, it's just sitting here on my desk. We got to return it in 2 weeks. Might as well just watch it as many times as I can.
get in from school. Let's start Alien again. And my own kids who are now actually grown up as well. But I'm somewhat jealous of their access that they have right from an early age, because you, in some ways, you work some of this repetitive viewing. Most kids today work that out of their system when they're kind of 3, 4, 5. Like we did this with Mary Poppins when our daughters were 4.
Right. Well, now it's like you have infinite choices, and so it takes sometimes an hour to find a movie to watch, because you're like, I have so many options. Which one do I watch?
Indeed.
Let me go on IMDb, see what the rating is, you know?
Exactly. Unless, of course, you come to IMDb and we help you find that next movie to watch. So this is all brilliantly connected.
You study computer science at the University of Leeds, and then how does IMDb kind of even come to you? I mean, I think there was a period of time, right, when you graduated and then started IMDb. Yeah. I guess, what did you do in between that time after university and then,
So to set the context, so let's go back to 81 if we can, because I'm now seeing so many movies, I can't keep track of what I've seen and what I haven't seen. So the classic thing to do is get yourself a paper diary and start to write down what you've seen on what day.
So for those who can't see, he's holding a paper diary that says 1980, I believe, right, on the front.
This is 1990. So this is my 90 diary. Yeah, this is the diary from the year that IMDb launched.
Very cool.
But back in 81, I started to write down, and I would take my diary to the video store, and then I would think, did I see this? And I'd be able to flip back and go, oh, yes, I did see this. I saw this whenever. But I am always interested in who made the movies. And really, from an early age, I remember reading credits. And in my mind, I would be remembering, oh, this director always works with this editor. this composer is often hired when this person in this other role is hired. And this, you get in this picture of this interconnected world. And it's the film and television industry. It is quite unusual in the way it operates, in that you have very skilled professionals who can be at the top of their game, or they can be climbing up the ladder, gaining experience, and they all physically arrive, make a brilliant film or a brilliant show, and then they go their different ways. But then behind the scenes, they've made connections, or, oh, I want to work with that director again, or, oh my goodness, that screenplay was brilliant. I want to find out what she writes next and attach myself to that project. Those kind of things that go on behind the scenes. So you've got this kind of like this industry of professionals that come in and out of each other's orbits over time. And sometimes those things work. And sometimes they don't work, and you often wonder, well, how did they go from A to B? so I'm fascinated by the credits. So my paper diary only has room for the titles. So I go to my home computer and I create a database to track my viewing and the credits. So from that point on, I would rewind the VHS tape after I'd seen the movie, press play again and pause, and I would type in the main crew, the main cast, what I thought of the movie, what it was about, the date I saw it, and just logged that in a database. This was all my own doing. You can go to Amazon Web Services or your favorite cloud provider and spin up a multi-terabyte database instance in seconds and fill it with data in barely seconds.
I mean, ChatGPT might be able to do it for you.
indeed. But this is kind of 14-year-old me manually typing credits.
Just for yourself.
Just for myself. Yeah, just for myself. There's no, it's 81, so there isn't really any online environment to be in. But it was fueling my interest in the credits and making these connections. Like how many films directed by Alfred Hitchcock starring Cary Grant have I seen? Oh, it's four, because there are four. That kind of thing is going on in the database. Simultaneously, 81 was quite an interesting year for me. What I also did was I manually, as far as I could from memory, backdated my database to the 1st of January 1980. So that's how I know even though I actually started logging it in 81, it wasn't too much effort to back remember what had I rented, what had I seen on TV, that kind of thing. So
Cole, was your mom or were your grandparents at all like concerned that, you know, you're just like watching movies all day? I mean because, you know, You do the math on 15,500 movies over, or even the 800 you watched last year, you know, and that's like 2 to 3 a day. I can only imagine what it was at the time. Or they just like, oh, this kid likes movies, like let him just do his thing.
No, they didn't understand me at all. So I have a very, very clear memory of the summer of 1981, and it's the school vacation for the big summer break.
Yeah,
and I'm in my bedroom and I'm busily working on my computer, and I'm maybe adding a new column to the database or writing a new report or something like that. And my mother burst into my bedroom, and she said, in a really kind of, you can only do this as a parent, this kind of perfect tone of, why don't you go outside and play? And I looked up from my computer and said, oh, Mom, I'm just adding this. And she rolled her eyes and left the room in a kind of semi-huff. Okay, semi-huff. However, the same summer, the video game industry is getting started in the UK. And this is my second brush with entrepreneurship. So, the 1.5p candy bag didn't last very long, but here's my next go. A family friend had a more powerful computer, and they knew that obviously I was quite involved in writing my own software, and they said, hey, I'll lend you my computer, and if you design and write some computer games, we can sell them, and I'll take a cut for lending you the computer. My mother, who was the secretary to a member of parliament in the UK, so the local secretary, so she's very skilled in admin and organisation. So she would manage the checks and the banking and go into the post office and things like that for another percentage, and then I would keep the rest. As the designer and writer of the computer games. Now this is very, very primitive computer games. Like when I tell this story these days, people think I'm talking about something with some kind of like real world game engine and thousands of characters. We're literally talking about blocks. Right. Blocks that move across the screen backwards and forwards that represent.
But I'm sure something. It was still fascinating back then, you know, for someone to see that on a computer, like, wow, I can play a digital game like this, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Very, very, very much so. So across the rest of the summer, I was typing things in. I was typing things into the computer from my VHS rentals and also designing video games. And so we got those onto the market in time for Christmas of 1981, and the orders just poured in with checks, and that kept me in anything a teenager could want at the time. So it was great from the perspective of clothes, records, obviously VHS rentals and VHS tapes, and eventually driving lessons. But it was quite a, it's that early kind of gaming world, was quite interesting, because the games companies were starting to launch, and there'd be obviously much more professional games being produced by early gaming studios, and the particular brand of computer that I was writing for, it wasn't the one that was most popular in the UK. So people were buying a different model, and the investment in games was going over there. So it was pretty clear that this wasn't gonna last. And I definitely wanted to go to college. Definitely wanted to go to college, because
why is that? Why did you go to college?
I could see the value in being properly educated. Yeah. As someone who'd been self-taught to program, the idea of going off to a college where there would be professors who are experts in software, and you would have access to all kinds of amazing computer systems, was something that appealed to me, versus this, that there was in the UK, there was a little bit of a sort of like rock star game designer cult type thing going on. So you'd see people in the media, and they were 16, 17, write in their own games for some of these early games companies, and they'd have like a flash car on their driveway, but they weren't old enough to drive it. They'd have a credit card, but they weren't old enough to be able to spend it. So I think I was rooted in kind of a much more sort of practical experience of the world. And possibly part of that may be growing up, spending many of my vacation time in my grandparents' convenience store.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point of sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/founderhour. Once again, go to shopify.com/founderhour to take your retail business to the next level today.
At the time in the UK, comparing it to, let's say, the US or other parts of the world, what was the technology, the computers, the video games, were they essentially kind of all in the same realm, or was the UK a little ahead? Was it a little behind? What was the kind of environment at the time of technology in the early, or is it, I guess, mid-80s at this point?
Yeah, early to mid-80s.
Yeah.
It's hard to judge that. Because of course there wasn't an internet that instantly connects everybody with that view. However, as a reader, avid reader of these very early computing magazines that they used to produce in the UK, they were full of product reviews of, say, like an Apple II. So I was aware that there was a computer company called Apple in California. Oh my goodness! Like, you know, might as well have been on Jupiter,
right?
As far as Manchester was concerned. But yeah, so I think things were
pretty much alike,
and there were UK computers that were being sold in the US and US computers being sold in the UK, and the technology because there was really so little difference between all of those things. They all had about the same speed processor, the same amount of memory, about the same size.
And technology is such an equalizer too, right? I mean,
and
even though the communication wasn't as robust as it is today in terms of being able to do a podcast from the UK and, you know, the US, you know, I think, like you said, word probably still can get around. And those that are kind of the nerdy ones or the geeky ones in the community, right? Like they're going to pick up on that stuff.
Indeed. Yeah. So 85, I'll walk us a bit faster. 85, I got online. So I got a modem in 85, and I went off to college as well. And so the college was connected to an early version of the internet as well. So I had email at college, I had email at home. And so all of a sudden, my very strange obsession with movies and movie credits wasn't so unique to me, because I was on mailing lists and I was going to bulletin boards and interacting with other fellow movie fans from around the world, never meeting them, but interacting with them via this early prototypical technology. So graduated college in 88. Moved down to Bristol. I got a job with Hewlett-Packard, HP Labs, who were at the time less than a mile away from where I'm standing right now. It's been an interesting kind of journey on there. When they brought me down for an interview in early 88, we stayed, they put all the candidates up in a hotel, and that hotel is along the country lane that we now live in. So very kind of
small world,
constrained small world type thing. So I got a job with Hewlett Packard, and it was 88 into 89. My now wife, so we've been married for coming up to 35 years. We were high school sweethearts. So we met when we were 16. We did a long distance relationship thing throughout our time at different colleges.
Please tell me your first date was at a movie theater.
An early date was at a movie theater. I can't.
You gotta revise history a little bit.
I wish I could say it worked like that. We were friends first, so we don't have a traditional first date. In that kind of sense, there was a moment when we switched from being friends to being a couple, but that happened outside of a bar in Manchester.
Sounds like a movie to me.
Oh, thank you. So in that 88, 89, my wife did a teaching degree, which required an extra year of college compared to me. So I'm down in Bristol. She's up at her college in the north of England, and we're waiting to get married in 89. And so that's when I really found myself in the world of Usenet, which was this very early text-based distributed discussion board system. And within Usenet, there was basically a board for every kind of topic that you could think of. And obviously, I found myself hanging out in the movie discussion group. And so people would always be asking back in those days, hey, I've just seen a movie with this person, or written by this person, or shot by this person. Can anyone recommend any other movies that they've also done? Now, of course, today, this is like, well, duh, go to IMDb and get all of this information. Right. But back then, there was an IMDb consisting only of the movies that I had seen on my computer. And then if you were lucky, you might have a printed guidebook. Like that, wow. that might have 20,000 entries or something like that. So I would always answer with the results of a query from my database. So this started to become a frequently asked question in the group, and one of the people in the group began a frequently asked questions list for actresses. And so I grabbed a copy of this file, imported it as a new table in my database, and then I was able to compare the difference between the credits that were in this file and the credits that I had. And so I could instantly give that person all of the actress credits that they didn't have. So this then meant that whenever I was seeing a new movie, I didn't have to type the actress credits in because I could pull them across. If you see how this works. But I'm a fan of all kinds of credits, and this is only good for actresses. So in August of 1990, by now, I launched an actors frequently asked questions list. And as soon as I posted that into the movie discussion group, people began to mail me with missing actor credits that from movies that I hadn't seen. And this was absolutely brilliant, because this thing it's essentially created a chain reaction. Here we are in the year of Oppenheimer, if I'm okay to make that comparison. So chain reaction going on here. Within a couple of weeks, I found myself managing another frequently asked questions list of acting credits. I won't go into the details, but it augmented what we had in the other two files. And then somebody mailed and said, "Hey, I'm a big fan of directors. Have you thought of adding directors, a director's credit list?" So I was busy with the bits that I was running. I mailed the person back and I said, "Well, I can give you the directors of every movie I've seen, some software to manage data coming in, some software to publish back out, and you can manage a director's FAQ." And they mailed back and said, "Yes." So there we go. We had cast and directors. September 90, somebody in the group said, "These files are great, but what we could really do with is a database so we can search them." And so I took bits of the software that I'd written to manage the data and publish it back out, combined that with some software that I specifically wrote for this purpose. And on the 17th of October, 1990, the very first version of the IMDb software was published by me into the rec.arts.movies Usenet group. And people could download the software, download the files, and just search on their own system for cast and director. 2 weeks later, somebody mails and goes, "I'm a big fan of writers." Rinse and repeat. 2 weeks later, "Big fan of composers." Rinse and repeat. And so across those early days, we recruited volunteers who cared passionately enough about some type of content that they wanted to see it added to the database, and they would be willing to do that. Now, there's no World Wide Web. There's no commercial use of the internet. So there's no one of the interesting things in my story is I didn't start with, "Oh, there's a huge business opportunity out there on the internet." It was almost the complete opposite. Wow, I can do this as a hobby on the internet, but if it ever turned into a business, this would not be something that you could do on the internet because it was forbidden.
Right.
It was forbidden. So this is such the opposite world in which we live today. So very, 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 very much a... maybe the internet stone age is the way to think
prehistoric about it. Times.
Yes, yeah. And we soon ran out of things that were in my database. So sometimes people would pop up and go, "Hey, I love quotes. I'd love to add a quote section." I wasn't logging quotes. So we just launched with like two quotes that somebody could think of. And then as soon as we posted it out there, people would start mailing in quotes back to us. Trivia, goofs, soundtracks, plot keywords, basically anything. And I would always say yes. There's a Jim Carrey movie called Yes Man. I don't know if you ever saw it, but
yes, I have seen it.
It's one of those things where, well, what's the worst thing that can happen if you always say yes?
And were you moderating all this, like all the stuff that was added to the, you weren't. Okay. Did you have moderators?
No. So I was in charge of, I had actors in those early days. I had actors. I had the, what we now call the additional crew section, which was the none of the above crew. Somebody in California was in charge of directors. Somebody in Switzerland was in charge of composers. Somebody in Norway was in charge of genres.
So it's up to everybody to maintain quality control of their data.
Yes. Yeah. So each person was, and it's one of those things, but by virtue of them wanting to manage this content, they were an expert in that content.
And Cole, from day one, was it always just, you just called this thing like an internet movie database? That's all, or no?
No. Are you ready for this? So because it grew out of the rec.arts.movies Usenet news group, we used to be the rec.arts.movies movie database scripts package.
That's nice, a long URL.
Yeah. Nice catchy name that was back at the time. So we were that. So there we were growing the number of people that were using the software and the number of people that were contributing. When in the summer of 93, I got an email from a guy called Rob Hartill. And Rob's email went something like this. Hey, Col, I just installed the movie database package. Think it's great. But have you heard of this World Wide Web thing? Because I think it might be quite big. And would love to write a wrapper around the software to create a web interface. So I had heard of the World Wide Web because someone in the same office as me had written a web browser. And so I replied back in my yes man style. Yep, sure, we'll have a web interface. So it was just another way that people would be able to engage with the IMDb content. So we launched. We were somewhere in the first 100-ish websites to launch. There used to be a website called What's New on the Web, and you could go back. They would list every new website that went live in the previous day, all two or three of them. So you could go back through time until you reached the beginning of the web, and then you would done the web. So somewhere in the first 100 websites to launch, there we were. We instantly filled up all the capacity at Cardiff University, or fairly instantly. Ended up with copies of IMDb all over the world in different college servers. And then 95, the web was certainly getting a lot bigger, a lot more mainstream. Our traffic was suddenly doubling every 2 weeks on a compound basis. So double, 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 double. And our little hobby was getting out of control. So we were faced with this difficult decision. Do we say that was a fun 5 years, but we can't do this anymore? Or do we see if we can sell some advertising, incorporate as a business, and maybe some of us could work part-time on keeping it better up to date?
And Cole, was this, I mean, were you doing anything else? How were you making money?
So I had a day job at HP, and some people had day jobs at other tech companies. Some people were still students. It was a mixture of things. And I mean, this is funny on particularly on your show here, because you might go, well, why have we got this guy on? Because he spent 5 years on the internet and hadn't launched a business. But you weren't allowed to run a business on the internet. When we were thinking about this, you could count the number of websites that were ad supported on two hands. Nobody knew if they were making any money. Nobody knew if there was going to be any longevity in any of this. But we agonized over what customers might think. Would people still send data in if we were a .com site? How would this work? We agonized over this for most of the second half of 1995. We agreed that we would incorporate as a UK company. Because I was in the UK, our webmaster was, as they used to be known, was in Wales. A couple of other people were in the UK as well. And so it made sense to incorporate in the UK. We figured out a formula to divide the share capital amongst, there were about 20 of us actively involved, amongst that 20, according to how long you'd been involved and how much work you were doing. So some people had only just arrived and were, give me everything, I can do that, I can do that, I can do that. And some people had been with us for like 5 years and were thinking, yeah, I'm just happy with my little section. And so we figured out a way that everybody was happy with what they were allocated. We also gave away shares to past contributors and our top data contributors, just a token amount of shares in each case, but a little thank you and kind of keep them involved and engaged, hopefully. So we did that. We launched imdb.com in time for the Oscars in 1996. It's always a special time of the year for me, the Oscars. We bought our first web server on a credit card. So we took no external funding whatsoever. We sent one of our US team members to his local computer store to buy a computer without one of our UK credit cards. He did that. We built a hard disk with all the operating system on and everything. We shipped it over to the US. They installed it into the computer, went to their local internet service provider. We'd struck a deal with them where we would promote them on the homepage in exchange for bandwidth. And IMDb.com launched in time for the Oscars. 2 weeks later, I am on the phone to our first potential advertisers. They'd never bought any advertising before. I'd never sold any advertising before. I guess I could sell computer games and 1.5 pence candy bars. but I'm on the phone and they are, so how much is it for a month? And I thought, well, we owe X on the credit card. I'm not going to tell you what X is, but it was the cost of one server in 1996. So I said, a month. Okay, 3X. And I told them the number. And they said, great, done. So hung up.
So you undervalued it, basically.
Possibly. hey, no, it was 3X.
Yeah.
So we paid off the credit card debt before it was due in the 4-week interest-free period. So we thus possibly became the world's first profitable internet company.
Possibly.
Who knows, you know, romanticizing.
No one's keeping track. So, unless there's another Cole Needham somewhere with a journal keeping track of profitable companies by year. And who knows, they might be on the podcast one day.
So bought some more web servers. The summer of 96, so just a few months later, we sold our first advertising to a movie studio, to 20th Century Fox for Independence Day, the big summer movie of that year. That was my cue to quit my day job. So I gave my notice in at work, became our first full-time employee. And from that point on, as the revenue run rate grew to afford another salary, I would call up the next volunteer shareholder and say, hey, quit your day job and join the team. Now, that would usually be the first time we'd ever spoken on the phone because we did everything via email. We never really met anybody else. When we incorporated in the UK, the four of us who were the initial directors of the company, the very first time we ever met in person was in the reception of our lawyer's office before we went upstairs to sign the incorporation paperwork. Mm-hmm. So I figured, speak to me on the phone. If you're going to quit your day job, you should at least speak to me on the phone. And so we were growing our team size, and the other people, of course, obviously they were still involved and they were working for the increase in equity of the IMDb shares, and waiting to make it to the top of the to be hired list, at which point they could join the full-time team wherever they were in the world. So, all going great. December 1997, I get an email from a guy called Alan Kaplan, and Alan's job title was General Counsel, Amazon.com. And Alan's email goes exactly like this, because I still have a copy. Hi, Cole. Jeff Bezos and I were discussing movie websites the other day. And naturally, IMDb came up in the conversation. We're going to be in the UK next month, and we would love to meet you to discuss some business ideas. Now, in Alan's email after Jeff Bezos, in parentheses, he'd written Amazon.com's founder and CEO. So,
and this is a, like a four-year-old Amazon. Like, ooh, I believe they had...
Less than four.
Three years old. Yeah.
December 97. So Amazon launched, it was launched in the summer of 95. Okay. Mm. And they had their IPO in May of 97. So they'd only been a publicly traded company for 7 months. They only sold books and they had never acquired another company. So, the context there, imagine if you were running a startup today and you got the email that I got, you'd be breaking out the exit champagne.
Before I would think it's fake. I'd be like, who's this scamming me right now? You know,
literally.
So we went along, we myself and one of the other UK team members, met with Jeff and Alan in a hotel room in London. Jeff explained how Amazon was going from selling books to music and then video, VHS tapes, and these shiny new round things called DVDs, if they ever catch on, and was looking for a site to partner with. Anything was possible, a content licensing deal so that Amazon could build an amazing video store experience with the IMDb data would be great, but much more interesting to Jeff would be if we would be acquired and become part of the Amazon family. Jeff had such a clear vision of how IMDb could fit within Amazon that by the end of the afternoon, we were thinking this could be a good thing. This could be a good thing. So I came home from London. I mailed the rest of the team, the rest of the shareholders, and it's so interesting, given the context at the time. Some people replied back with, wow, this is amazing. This is great. And then other people were saying, wait a minute, Amazon.com, they're not making any money. They're famously unprofitable. Amazon.com, you mean Amazon.bomb, was one of the phrases that was bandied around.
The memes of the time.
Yeah, so there's that like totally different kind of atmosphere, and so we discuss this over email. I go out to Seattle. Jeff introduces me to the rest of the management team. We have further discussions, and then on the 24th of April 1998, IMDb became a wholly owned subsidiary of Amazon.com. Now, unbeknownst to us, Amazon had been negotiating with a couple of other companies at the same time. And so we were announced as this package of three companies that had been acquired altogether. So nobody gets to say who was first. We were all either jointly first or however you want to think about it. But Amazon had acquired a UK bookseller. And obviously the media coverage of this was, wow, Amazon.com is expanding into the UK, into selling books in the UK. The next company was a German company, which obviously then led to the media saying, well, Amazon.com is going to be expanding into selling books in Germany. And then, oh, IMDb.com? Film and television database? why is Amazon acquiring IMDb? Oh, okay. Well, so that's where things were. We obviously, as part of this, everybody already employed by IMDb.com instantly has received a Amazon.com job offer. And anybody on the waiting list also received an Amazon.com job offer. And so they were able to take everybody on board. Some people were a bit worried about the future. and they chose to stay at their regular job or on their regular PhD course or whatever, and do it part-time instead of joining full-time, because they really weren't sure how this was going to work out. But kept me on to run it, everybody else, and there we are. So the Amazon Video Store launches in the US in November of 98. And then the media are thinking, oh, now we see why Amazon bought IMDb. Then the UK Video Store launches. Oh, now we see why Amazon bought IMDb. And we kind of progressed over those years within those early days in Amazon. It was great from the following perspective. One of our team had volunteered to move to Seattle to act as a kind of ambassador between IMDb and Amazon, which is a great, great thing to happen, because whenever they would be suggesting things to us, they would route them through our ambassador. And whenever we were asking about things that we could do, we would route them through our ambassador.
And you were operating as like a standalone company,
yes,
like
correct.
Outside of Amazon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In fact, I mean, going back to the actual meeting with Jeff, Jeff heard the story of how IMDb had been founded, and he said, well, this shouldn't work on paper. You're all in different countries. You've pretty much never met each other. You work on this mostly by email. You coordinate everything by email. Yet I can see the IMDb website exists, and I love it, and I can see it has all these features, and it's growing and developing, and you care deeply about your customers. You're built by your customers. So all of these brilliant things that kind of connected Amazon and IMDb together. But I don't see how this can work. So Jeff specifically said his role was not to break any of the magic. Not to break any of the magic. We're going to try and leave you alone as much as we can, but at the same time, help you as much as we can, which is a wonderful position to be in. And again, just feel very fortunate to have met Jeff exactly then, exactly when Amazon was thinking of doing this, because it just played out so well.
Cole, was it obvious to you at the time that you guys had that meeting with Jeff that Amazon would become what Amazon has become? I mean, I guess looking back to, you know, those conversations, was it obvious at all that this was like a special person who would build a company like that?
Special person, absolutely, immediately, yes. Absolutely.
What was it? What was it? Can you pinpoint, yeah, like what,
yeah,
it was?
Yeah. Jeff is such a visionary. He operates at a level that I've never met anybody in my life that thinks the same, operates the same, is such a long-term visionary, yet that can execute on those tiny details that make all of the difference to a business's success. So we got on exceedingly well together. He's absolutely my business hero. He remains a close friend to this day, and I again feel very fortunate to have joined Amazon at that time, to have had Jeff as a mentor for all of that time. And it's one of those things where we're all Jeff's mentees. every single person at Amazon today, million and a half people around the world that work for Amazon, we're all Jeff's mentees. And so So that was very obvious that this was a special person, and that and Jeff could paint this picture of how we could operate together as two businesses better than we could operating apart. But there's no way, and there's no way anybody could have predicted that the book e-tailer that we met with in January 1995 could become one of the most awesome and admired companies in the history of worldwide business.
Yeah, really.
I'm always a little skeptical when people have ended up where they are and they say, "Oh, I knew we would be exactly where we were." It's kind of like I think you could not tell the impact that the internet and that technology would have on the world back then, and you could not have foreseen the opportunities that there are today. And as we're very fond of saying at Amazon, it's still day one.
Right.
Like I've had coming up to I'm right, aren't I? 27 years is 10,000 days. Yeah.
26 years.
Yeah. So I'm coming up to 26 years as part of Amazon, and that's the kind of 10,000 day mark. But it really is 10,000 day ones. And I still have this feeling of there's so much more we can learn. There's so much more that we can do. And everything that we're doing today is just a tiny, tiny, tiny piece.
Talk to us a little bit about that, like your longer term vision. Where do you see sort of this intersection, right, of film and technology? I mean, these are two separate industries, but you're sort of right in the intersection of it. Where do you see it going? Where do you want it to go? Like, what is your sort of grand vision?
Well, the funny thing is we've changed the wording of our vision. We've tweaked odd words over the 35 years, but fundamentally, we've been saying the same thing since 1990, or even actually in my case, since before 1990. And the vision really is that IMDb powers the creation, discovery, and enjoyment of entertainment everywhere. Okay. Now back in 1990, entertainment meant movies and TV. discovery meant you can read a list down a filmography of what somebody's done. Everywhere meant a huge desktop computer and a very slow modem. and that is it. But then in all of those years since, the boundaries, technology has blurred the boundaries between all of the different kinds of entertainment that are around. When does something stop being a movie and become a video game? When is a video game like a movie? When is a podcast really a web series? All of these things are just ways in which storytellers get to tell their story to their audience, and their audience gets to engage in the story that's been told in whatever media environment that is. So I'm a huge fan of connecting storytellers to their audiences, and that's really a core thing that IMDb is all about. Way back in 1990, is today, and will be hopefully for many, many decades to come as well, is that ability to connect people to that content in ways that weren't possible before. And as a storyteller, It's never been easier to tell your story. Once upon a time, you had to own a large movie studio, all of the equipment, and have all of the financial resources to film a story and distribute it to your audience. Nowadays, anyone can pick up a mobile phone, start to shoot a story. They can edit it on their phone. They can do the visual effects for it on their phone. They can distribute it from their phone. It can be out there on the internet, and somebody in a country they've never heard of, a culture they're not familiar with, can be watching that story, and that story can impact that audience member's life. So that's the kind of storytelling environment that we find ourselves in. And then from an audience perspective, as I discussed earlier, you can then consume that in a movie theater. You can consume that on your regular size TV. You can consume that on a tablet, on a phone, on a VR or AR goggle set. All of those spaces that you can feel that story are continually evolving at the same time. So it's super exciting. And that's one of the things that engages me so much about the area that we're in, is simultaneously the innovation in technology, the innovation in entertainment, and the innovation in the distribution models that exist.
I just have one last question before we wrap up. You know, IMDb clearly has, you know, created so much impact in the world, not just film, but all these different entertainment sort of mediums that you talk about. And just anyone who's interested in this has, I mean, surely heard of and probably visited and used IMDb. Along the way, you know, what were some, or I guess what was like the biggest challenge that you feel like IMDb faced and maybe continue to face moving forward, that is like this piece that you're like, maybe wake up in the morning and try to, you know, really just like get a little bit better at solving?
So this is very much an Amazonian thing, but we genuinely are obsessed with our customers. So I'm very much motivated by being able to wake up and find a new customer problem to solve, or find a new piece of technology that the team can work on, and we can build something together for our customers. So absolutely, very much that is the thing. But in terms of challenges, especially for people who are listening who may be at different points of their entrepreneurial journey. I mean, first of all, the big decision for us was, of course, whether we would be acquired by Amazon. And certainly not needing to be acquired by anybody is a very good position to be in when you're in that kind of a negotiation. So we were not looking to be acquired or to exit in any way, and I'm not looking to exit in any way 26 years later. The beauty of doing something like this that I love is that, of course, you're never truly at work. There are minor exceptions to that. You're never truly at work, but equally, on the other hand, you're never truly not at work. So it does have this little interesting balance between it there. So kind of like the key decision is kind of like, well, you know, what is the future? Now, here we go. Let me go all the way back to, we were, actually, I better not mention the specific year. So much earlier in our history, and every year we would present to the Amazon leadership team on, hey, here's our plan for the upcoming year. Here's how we did last year. Here's our plan for the upcoming year. And they grill you. they grill you hard on those plans, and they challenge you. And it's kind of, well, this is growing by X. What does it take to grow that by 2X? Or what is required to do this? Or how do you do that? And things like that. And one of the Amazon S team, another business hero of mine, Jeff Wilkie, former CEO of worldwide retail for Amazon, only saw him a couple of months ago. Jeff Wilkie said at the end of this presentation, he said, so you're about 75 people. As I say, this is going back many, many years. About 75 people. I said, yeah. You know everyone who works at the company, don't you? And I said, yeah, I know absolutely everyone who's on the team. And he said, you're about to go into a growth period where you're not going to know everybody. And this is like such a key point in the business. You have to let go of knowing all of the details. It's great to know all the team, and I still personally welcome every team member that joins IMDb. We have a virtual one-on-one coffee these days, or an in-person one if they happen to be hired locally. What I describe as a history and vision talk. Every time we hire above a certain number of people, we all
now they could just listen to this podcast and it could save you some
well,
time.
Yes, indeed. So there's except that of course we're always continually evolving, and the everything I've said in this podcast is 100% true and accurate today. but the entropy is going to happen, and bits of the business are going to change, and bits of things are going to grow in ways that we never thought possible when we were in this point in 2024. So Jeff said, just be very careful about the mechanisms that you put in place to stay in touch with what the team is doing, and ensuring that as people come aboard, they're aligned with the vision of the company. They know how they can contribute, because we're only as good as the people that we've hired, the people who are on the team. And that was, and he was 100% right. He was 100% right. But then the other side of this, and you don't often hear so much about this, the other side of this is, as a company grows, especially one that's got the kind of history that IMDb has, where we all grew out of, we needed IMDb. We created IMDb because we needed IMDb. We added quotes because we needed somewhere to go to get those movie quotes. We added recommendations because we wanted to use IMDb to generate personalized recommendations. We added trailers because we're a trailer buff. Those kind of things. So as the company grows, there can be this natural tendency for people in senior positions to lose contact with the customer front line. You hire people who manage teams, and those teams develop things, or those teams support this bit of the business, and those teams have team members who talk to the customers. And you're then possibly, potentially finding yourself in a vacuum, isolated from those customers. And customer needs do not stand still. Customer problems are not set in stone. Every time there's a change in technology, every time there's a new type of entertainment, every time there's something that you can do that you couldn't previously do, there are people out there that know more about that than you do. And those people often are not even on your team, and they know more about that than you do. But the one thing that's great about the online environment is, of course, people are not shy at telling you what you should be doing. People are not shy about that at all. So it's super important. And, I do this myself. I try and teach this to my direct team members, and they, you know, down the organization, is to, A, of course, use IMDb as a product yourself. And we're always talking about movies, and we're always talking about TV shows, and we're always looking things up. And I encourage people to contribute data themselves to IMDb, that kind of thing that gives you that sort of passion. But not everybody is as not everybody is as passionate about movies and entertainment as I am. Sometimes people are passionate about business intelligence. Sometimes people are passionate about software development. Sometimes people are passionate about helping customers solve a particular class of problem. So you can't always rely on having people that are fully immersed. So that's why it's super important to stay in touch with what customers are doing, how they're engaging with your product. Listen to what they're saying. Listen to the criticism, because some of those truest points come across in this. You're letting me down here. You're letting me down there. You're letting me down here. And those are always challenges for us to do better here, there, and everywhere we possibly can. But we also have this other challenge in all of this, which is, as well as listening to your customers and trying to listen to what they're actually telling you, you also have to anticipate needs that they don't know they have yet, things that are going to be true in the future, and trying to think of how you can help those customers solve those problems before they even know they have that problem. And that's one of Amazon's, I think, great successes and great secrets there. Is that ability to invent on behalf of the customer. And so trying to think our way into the future, which is how we've ended up in this situation. So we're now 35 years old this year, 26 years as part of Amazon.com. And you might think, oh yeah, wow, join IMDb. There mustn't be anything left to do. And all I've learned over the 35 years is how much more is left to do than we've built already. We've been very fortunate to be growing throughout this period. And last year, so 2023, we had a record number of new titles submitted to IMDb. We had 4.5 million titles added in 2023. We have 17 million titles in total from 1890s early experiments in cinema, all the way through to the fifth Avatar sequel in 2031. 17 million titles, but 4.5 million of those were added last year. So there's never a dull moment. You can never think, oh, we've cracked the scaling problem.
Yeah,
because things are the customer numbers are going up, the amount of content that we've got is going up, then the ability to draw connections between that content becomes even more important. And so you need new technology, you need new solutions, things that worked just a few years ago. And so people say to me, they say, so Carl, wow, you've been at Amazon for 26 years. How come you're still there? And to me, it's still as exciting in 2024 as it was in 1998, as it was in 1990, as it was in 1981. It's still as exciting then, today.
That's incredible.
And every 18 months, I would say, there's about 50% of what I'm doing today I won't be doing in 18 months' time, and that'll be replaced by a new 50% of things. But that 50% it's not always the same things are always fixed and the same things are always changing. It's to do with size of the team, size of the business, available technology, things that our customers want to do, things that we want to do. And so I know that my role is just going to evolve, and I can't think of a better place to do that than at IMDb as part of the bigger Amazon, serving customers in a space that I love. I mean, I genuinely am my own service's biggest fan.
Yeah. No, I feel that. I was about to say, I feel like you're the perfect person to have built this, because I feel the passion from you, and I'm so happy that you found this kind of calling, this thing that you were able to build, and something that so many people, you know, hundreds of millions of people enjoy and get to experience, myself included. So it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and learn about it. And hopefully maybe down the line, as you said, there's so much new things that's, you know, that's going to come about. Maybe we could do a part two at some point. And, but yeah, we can't thank you enough for being here and sharing your incredible journey with us. And we appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. So I love talking about IMDb.
I love hearing you.
So
thanks for being a part of it.